published in 1968 as Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And later turned into a movie entitled Blade Runner, starring Harrison Ford, Daryl Hannah, and Rutger Hauer. This is a story that some may consider a cult movie. Greg and I do our thing and analyze and dissect and reveal more about the story than your average conscientious book reviewer might do, but it's well-intentioned spoilering of the highest order. I also misname Dr. Noonien Sung from Star Trek as Dr. Jung, but that may have been a Freudian slip not lost on the great man's students. Thank you, Greg, as always, for your witty analysis, and sorry about the evil laugh at the end, which I had to keep in there as the episode fades out. I've also delayed the outro so you get the full effect. This is Two and a Mic. Rise up and be curious.
Jepek kuduelo mabiro e tu anda mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawoye tu anda mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinji e tu anda mic. Wola wachokre wabed piny bi wawinje. Ero chako dumomit ndi
tu and a mic.
Podcast makende.
Greg is back for another episode of this book review thingy that we do. Greg, how's it going?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, 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 good. You've got the aquarium going in the background.
I do.
But yeah, is that them talking, or is that like, are there people in the warehouse?
There's people in the warehouse.
Okay, cool. All right, fair enough. Yeah, so do you want to tell us about the book we're going to be analysing?
We've done that thing we sometimes do where we're going to compare and contrast a book and a film, not of the same name this time. So the book is Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and the film's, of course, Blade Runner.
Yeah. Well, you say, of course, almost like it's intuitive. But all right, can we first of all analyze the name? Because it's not the most inspirational name, is it? Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And the novel was published in 1968. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that in the 1960s, there was a lack of creativity when it came to naming books. So what do you think that refers to?
I think there's a lot more to the name than just, I don't think it immediately would grab you to say, right, definitely got to read this book necessarily, but it might make you think the strange name. Let me read the blurb. And once you read the blurb on it, I think that might make you want to read the book, even in 1968. I think the reason it's named thus is because the whole setup of the book is there to make you think about what it means to be human, what it means to be an android, and the possibilities of one becoming another, maybe. Or at least the confusion between one another.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was quite a funny title as well. I believe I agree with you. I think we're all familiar with this suggestion that if you find it hard to sleep, then you should count sheep jumping over the fence and so on. And I think you only really have trouble sleeping if you either have an issue with conscience or something troubles you. And in itself, conscience suggests an emotional intelligence, which is something which people probably wouldn't necessarily connect with an android or a robot.
I can see that. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think also it asks the question that if you accept that an android can dream, has it already gone beyond its programming? Is it more than just an android? It kind of relates a little bit to the Turing test, doesn't it? That whole thing about how can you tell the difference between a human and an android? So the Turing test famously is a set of questions which if you'd be able to ask a human and an android, would an android be able to pass? So that the person listening on the other end would not understand whether it's an android they're speaking to or a human. Now, there are different tests. There's a different set of tests which they have in the book and also in in the film, which they used to analyze emotion. And emotion seems to be what they see as the main difference. So the androids are perfectly capable of lying through any number of questions that they're asked. But when emotion is also added as an element into the questioning, that's where the android apparently seems to fall short. And the detective is able to tell that it's an android that they are testing. Yep. So I thought that was an interesting concept.
Definitely. I mean, we've probably started at the wrong point, even though it's the title and it's what people would pick up. But then we've kind of jumped into essentially what the book is. So let's talk about the book, sort of like the plot or where it starts and some of the main characters. And then people will be able to pick up on exactly what we're talking about through that introduction. So do you want to introduce the book then?
The book itself is the setup is you've got a detective stroke Blade Runner, and his job is to retire or kill androids who have escaped from the Mars colony or whichever colonies they've been assigned to work. They're basically used as slave labor in this existence, in this world. Go ahead.
Can we also point out that this was supposed to have occurred at a certain time? Is it, this is supposed to be 1992. So by 1992, which in a later version, this was extended to 2021. But in the original book, what the author, Philip K. Dick, said, or in this case wrote into his novel, was that there will have been a nuclear war.
Yeah.
Okay. And on the basis of there having been a nuclear war, humans had developed colonies on other planets. One of them had been Mars. And that's why these six renegade robots or androids have escaped Mars and are now living on Earth. And therefore, they need, I presume this is quite a regular occurrence, and that's why they have an entire career set out for individuals called Blade Runner.
Yeah. So the Blade Runners are out there to intercept and retire escaped androids. So in the book, at least, not in the film, but in the book, Rick Deckard is the Blade Runner that we meet. He's married. That's the bit which is different. So he's got a wife at home, and I think in the book she's supposed to be some kind of emotional anchor to his character, because he's quite unemotional. Whereas she has an emotional filter, and she also seems to want to engage with her negative emotions, so fear, self-loathing, all the she actually makes one point dialing up her emotional filter, which is she seems to have a setting that she can just set it however she wishes to. And they discuss about him coming home and sort of perking her up later, beginning of the book. I mean, that was something, it didn't really go in much further than that, but it was just an interesting aside that the wife had this kind of emotional aspect to her. Later on in the book, she does, again, sort of emotionally, she tends to start caring for this toad that he brought back. Mechanical toad, of course, because real ones don't exist anymore after the nuclear explosion. So that's the other part of the setup is after the nuclear war, real animals pretty much are so rare that they are totally, you know, collector's pieces. So if you can, you get companies that are out there who manufacture fake animals. And the richer you are, the more of a status symbol it is to have a pretty good animal, and one that's realistic enough for you to pretend to feed.
The ultimate status symbol is to have a real animal.
Yeah, but they are so expensive.
They're extremely expensive. And that's also one of the reasons why Deckard is so willing, as it were, to risk his life, because he wants to buy a real animal.
I mean, again, this is one of the main plot lines that doesn't come through in the film at all. You do see an owl, which is so realistic, when he visits the Tyrol Corporation. This owl's brought into focus, and you know, he says, "Wow, that must be really expensive to have such a realistic owl." But it's not this whole thing of all running throughout the book is his preoccupation of having to make all this money. That's why he's doing it. That's why he's gone for this job, this risky job, to try and end these androids who are much stronger than him, much faster than him, could clearly kill him at any time. but he needs the money to get, you know, it's his entire justification for doing what he's doing.
Yeah, but I think in the book, he wants to buy a real goat.
Yes.
Which he can feed real, yeah. And it has to have, then he has to pay for food and he has to pay for maintenance and so on. We won't talk about what happens thereafter to the goat, but isn't he wants to collect $6,000 or whatever the units are so that he can afford to buy this animal. Yeah. What he actually has is an electric sheep, yes. Which exists on the roof, and everybody thinks that it's a real sheep. But as you say, it's too expensive for a normal police officer, I guess, to be able to afford a real animal. So therefore, it's an electric one. And so this is a status thing, and it's quite embarrassing, and they don't let people come close to it. And so it's a very, very odd world, I think it's fair to say. What the author believed would happen in 1992... Fortunately,
I'm really by that Philip K. Dick believed this would happen in 1992. I think he's created a world from his imagination in 1968 that could potentially something similar to that could happen if we have a world, you know, a world war, nuclear.
Well, this is just after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Is it? Let's not forget. Yeah, I think it was 61, 62. You had the Cuban Missile Crisis. So probably at the time when he was writing this book, it was published in 68. So either around the time that he was writing this book or just before he started writing the book was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, and also 1960s is unfortunately the decade of assassinations. So therefore, some serious political instability around the world. So people perhaps looking at it from that perspective, for them, a nuclear war was not very far away.
Oh, no. No, so I mean,
I wouldn't be surprised.
When we were growing up, the nuclear war didn't seem that far away necessarily at times.
But we didn't. See, what's funny, it's another thing that's funny, yeah? We never did lessons in school that we'd have to hide under the table. I know people who were born on the other side of the Berlin Wall in the 80s. And 70s and 80s, they had to actually take lessons for what to do if there was an attack. Mm-hmm. And so therefore hiding under tables and stuff like that, which is quite interesting.
It is interesting, but I'm not sure how effective it would have been hiding under a table in the UK.
No, that's true. That's true. I'm not sure whether or not they just simply tried to say to kids, you're on your own. But if you hear the missile alarm, as it were, ring, then this is what you got to do. But
I understand what you're saying. I just think probably here the understanding was if you hear a nuclear bomb, you just say your prayers.
Clearly, that's what I think would have been the reality of it. But just to bring it back then. Okay, so I actually think that Philip K. Dick thought, okay, do you know what? Within the next 24, 25 years, I think there is going to be a nuclear war. And if there isn't, who gives a shit? I'm going to put it out there. And I think that's...
He probably thought to himself, he may have had the idea for this book and thought, what sort of world do I want to set it in? How can I describe a world which this kind of scenario might fit? And so he's probably come up with, well, there is a possibility of a nuclear war. And if we have a nuclear war with nuclear winter, what's Earth going to look like? So he uses imagination to come up with a feasible planet and a reason for that in order to fit the narrative of his book.
And also another thing we should mention is, and we were just talking about it off mic when we were discussing TV series, and you mentioned For All Mankind, the 1960s was also the time of the space race.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's key. That, I think that's also key to it as well. So the fact that, and of course, he's imagined that by 1992 we've reached Mars. Of course, and for All Mankind does that too. You know, we get to Mars, and of course the difference is the people who wrote For All Mankind, I imagine, already knew that we didn't get to Mars by the 1990s. So it is interesting that in 1968 or whenever he wrote the words was a possibility in their minds that, you know, once the moon's established, shortly thereafter we'll be able to grab Mars. Of course, the difficulties of getting to Mars mean that's not going to happen for a long time yet.
No, but this is the premise that I really like about For All Mankind. Is in, we don't want to go too much off track here, but I like the fact that what they're saying is the reason why our adventures in space came to such a sudden end was basically because we'd won the race. Is it the West, theoretically, had won the race, and therefore the Soviet Union was so far behind, they were so underfunded, that there was no point really pushing ourselves, and let's just forget it, guys. And then it just basically, yeah, fell by the wayside on when you think that most of those funds which would perhaps have been spent on developing space programs were then invested in the Vietnam War and further, I suppose, Cold War related activities. So, I mean, I think that premise is actually quite interesting in For All Mankind, that they're saying, but actually the race element, yeah, was in effect because we had to always get one up on the Soviets or the communists. And I really like that premise, if you know what I mean.
I think that was very interesting. I mean, let's not get too far into discussing a different show, which is maybe for another time. But indeed. But I agree with you on that point, that it takes it into an interesting place. Had the West not won, or the US not won the space race to reach the moon, would then Mars have been seen as the next attainable goal?
Yeah. But then it also speaks, I mean, this little sort of sortie into For All Mankind also allows us somewhat to get into the mentality of Philip K. Dick, because in the 60s, it seems that the creative types fully expected over the next two decades that the space race would perhaps have developed in that kind of a direction. And so therefore, to have a colony on Mars was a possibility for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but perhaps the intricacies and differences of getting to Mars, time wise, nothing else, wasn't something that they could conceive at the time. Perhaps in the next few decades, who knows? They will find a way to get humans on Mars. I have no idea about that. But
well, let's not forget that Elon Musk had promised his Mars One project would start in 2015, and that they would land on Mars this year in 2025. Mm-hmm. And also, let's not forget that NASA had promised that their Mars colonization mission would start in 2025 and arrive in 2035. And neither of these have started. So therefore, we are very far away from this.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I remember going to there was a Mars exploration exhibit at the Design Museum in London a few years ago. And I remember going to that, and they tried to show what a Mars landing expedition would look like and how they could deal with some of the problems on Mars that exist to try and get a colony on Mars. And it would be an absolute feat of engineering. It really would. With the technology available today, at least, to get a colony started on Mars, it would be ridiculously difficult and time-consuming and expensive to do.
Yeah, and of course a one-way journey, so this is also something to take into account. But okay, we have moved away somewhat from the book, and so we should somewhat saunter back towards it. Okay, so you've established, and there are some parts of the book which are very different to the movie. There's one other element though that I think we should talk about from the book, which is nowhere referenced in a movie. It's this Mercerism, and that's also connected to the wife, because there is this emotion box.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And she has the ability to dial it up and down to actually change how she feels and accepts emotion. Which, as I said, that's an interesting concept, not one I've come across anywhere else.
But I mean, what is that a metaphor for? As in, it seems to me, it's people are. In German, there's a word called Weltschmerzen. So basically, it's where you have the pain of the world on your shoulders, and you suffer from world pain, so to speak. And it seems to me that they could be saying that after such a nuclear war, that people would basically be suffering to such an extent that there would be a need for self-punishment in some kind of a religious or cult setting, which appears to be what this mercerism thing is. It's almost like a cult, isn't it, really, the way they present it?
Yeah. I mean, again, as you say, it's not really explored in the film whatsoever. But in the book, it's much larger role to play. I feel as though the film is much more about feel and tone and setting rather than actual. The plot in the book is much thicker. There's a lot more going on in terms of plot in the book than there is. The film's all sort of almost film noir in the way he's made. He's sometimes addressing directly to the audience, sometimes talking to himself almost. You've got that kind of jazzy saxophone music in the background with keyboards. There's a lot of setting. It's that kind of soft mood lighting.
It is the 80s.
Yeah, it is the 80s. But I think it was meant to look like that. But it's a lot about the look of it as opposed to staying true to the book.
There are how many years? There are 14 years between the book's release date and the movie coming out. So they definitely had time to think about it if they wanted to. I kind of feel when I was going through the book, I thought to myself, there is hardly any action in this book. It's a lot of self-reflection. There's a lot of argument, debate, recrimination. There's a lot of theorizing. There's a lot of talk about mercerism and so on. But the actual scenes where somebody dies is over almost before it begins. As in, it feels like one page and boom, the killing part is done. Whereas in the movie, it's the other way around.
Absolutely.
There's hardly any theorizing. You have to really read between the lines to try to understand the little symbology. I mean, you mentioned the owl. Okay, that was quite obvious. But again, it doesn't really go into too much detail. In the book, it's a real owl.
Yeah. But there's a long conversation about it.
Yeah.
It was something that he couldn't get over about just how much it must have cost to get this out. He's gone to the Tyrol Corporation. He must know these guys are worth loads of money. So if anyone's going to have a real owl, why not them?
And the owl becomes a part of the sweetener for him to take on the role because he doesn't want to do it. You know, so there is that significant element in the book, which is, as you say, it's not even mentioned. I can't remember whether or not you said it or not, but in the movie, he doesn't have a wife.
No, she doesn't have a wife. No.
Yeah. So that's also different.
Yeah. In the movie, they made Rachel, who's the android that works at Tyrol Corporation, doesn't know she's an android. In the film, so she's his romantic interest, that Rachel, the android. But the book itself, and also the film, I believe, asks the question whether or not Rick is himself a human or also an android, and he doesn't know it. So at one point in the film and also in the book, Rachel asks him directly, have you tested yourself with this test? And it just leaves it out there as to whether or not he himself is really a human or an android.
I'm kind of struck by the meaning behind that question, because obviously as the reader, we kind of believe he's a human, and why would you even ask that question? For us, of course, he's a human. The whole movie or the whole book is written from the perspective of this person as being a human. But I get the meaning behind that being, who cares? What's the difference? Just because you're a human doesn't necessarily mean that you have more of a right to life than I do as an android. In fact, I am the perfect replica of an adult human in every way. And this is further emphasized by the fact that in both the movie and the book, there's a love scene between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So that would not be possible if we were only talking about nuts and bolts, quite clearly.
Of course. No, these robots or androids are made so realistically that it is by their design that you can't tell physically if they are one or other. The main difference, which we haven't mentioned yet, is the lifespan, which I found to be a very interesting idea, which is that the androids are given a 4-year lifespan. I suspect that's to stop them taking over. If they're given a longer lifespan or similar lifespan to humans, they could literally take over, because they're much stronger, as mentioned, and could very easily do away with the human overlords, as it were. So in the film, we see Rutger Hauer's character, Roy Batty. His whole mission seems to be that he's come to Earth to find his creator, to find out if he can extend his life beyond the 4 years that he's been given. So that was an interesting part of the plot, an idea that he had about keeping androids in check.
I mean, obviously the question is asked, well, why didn't you make the batteries or the energy rechargeable? But that clearly wasn't a part, as you say, of the design behind the concept of whether or not giving these beings the possibility of having eternal life, then the argument of whether or not there's even a need for humans exists thereafter. So you know, these things are potentially so much.
I think he's almost sort of preempted the AI question there. If you have androids with the physical advantages they have and provide them with humanoid style brains with the ability to understand a notion of self and then give them the ability to live for beyond human lifespans and potentially almost forever, what is the point of humans at that point from the point of view of an android?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you mentioned artificial intelligence, and that for me was the main element which I took away from it. So in 1968, the issue was androids. I mean, they were talking about artificial intelligence then, but artificial intelligence then, they were still trying to get the machine to play chess. Obviously, our understanding now of what artificial intelligence might be, even though in most cases it's an algorithm, but still we believe there to be a certain meaning behind the combination of the term artificial intelligence. But I find the story posing the question for androids something that we may thereafter or hereafter have to consider also from the perspective of artificial intelligence. If we can marry artificial intelligence with a physical android or robotic anatomy of some sort, or skin or sleeve, to use different TV series. And so therefore, I think maybe there are certain theoretical elements that we could take from this. But also, you know, you and I, as Star Trek fans, we've kind of grown up with this debate regarding Commander Data, mm-hmm. haven't we? So yep. There is a lot of that which is also included here. I mean, Data, lest we forget, has a romantic relationship with Tasha Yar.
Right.
If you remember.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
Yeah. So therefore, these are themes which are very well visited through that medium of Star Trek.
But of course, this would have been written already before the Data character. So perhaps that's with some foreknowledge that Data's storyline developed as it did. I don't know. That would be interesting to find out. But I hadn't really given that much for thought, almost.
Yeah, but and also let's not forget, Data's a completely different creature in the sense that his circuitry and whatever programming,
positronic brain, was that the thing?
The positronic brain and so on. Yeah, I mean he will live as a character for what, 200, 300, 400 years? I don't know. So obviously there is a very different creation story behind Commander Data. It's also Dr. Jung that creates him. Is an individual and not an entire corporation. So there is a big difference between these elements, I think, or these storylines. So anyway, let's go back to androids and electric sheep. Did you enjoy the story?
I tell you what, I mean, I had seen the film originally, and I hadn't read the book until last year. I'd seen the film maybe when I was probably about 13 or 14 years old, 15 perhaps. And I must admit, I watched it more as an action film than anything else. So there are, you know, the action scenes that do exist were quite interesting to me. I never gave it much thought. That's what I'm trying to say. So I enjoyed it to a point, and then and I never really revisited it or wanted to watch it a second time, because I thought, okay, I've seen that, done it. It's, you know, nothing more to see here. But I picked up the book almost by accident last summer, and I knew that it was Blade Runner, but I thought I'd give it a go. It's actually not very, it's not a very big book anyway, so it doesn't take very long to read. But once I started, I really enjoyed the book, I thought. I found. So the book I would definitely recommend. I like the fact it's very introspective. It makes you wonder, because it tells you a lot about his inner dialogue, his thoughts, what he's thinking about, and what his motivations are during the book. It's his interactions with different members of the cast, as it were. The other, and one person we haven't mentioned yet, who is quite central to the book, and he appears in the film, but he has a very minor character. Is Isidore, or his name is the chap who. So you have this character who he's not the brightest tool in the box. Let's put it that way. So he has some mental issue, which means that he's considered to be not bright enough to take part in normal societal jobs. He's very much downtrodden and lives in this strange sort of apartment, which links to the nuclear holocaust. No one else lives in. He's there by himself. He's got a whole building to himself. And then he meets Pris, which is one of the androids who have escaped. And he befriends her. In the film, she's completely using him to get her own ends, which is to get the leader of the androids, the Roy Batty character, to have a meeting with the creator, Tyro Corporation. That's not the same relationship in the book. In the book, there seems to be much more of a sort of protective friendship going on there, although the Roy Batty character also shows up in the book. But interestingly, he has been downtrodden by humanity. He's completely outshone in terms of intellect by these androids. So it seems to be asking a question about the validity of questioning whether androids have a right to exist. It's also questioning, what about characters such as Isidore? So, because he's already shunned from society, he's already been almost cast aside. He lives away from anyone else. He does have work. He works for a company that seems to make or repair robotic animals.
His colleagues constantly insult him.
His colleagues constantly. So, but I mean, it's really, his character is a very interesting one in the book. Mm-hmm. In the film, you just don't understand who he is. It's, you know, he just seems to be this sort of slow guy who can't really talk. He's got all these automatons in his flat, and you don't really understand why they're there. You know that he works for a Tyro Corporation. That's explained to you. Mm-hmm. But I just felt that his character had a lot more to give in the film than it was given. I thought they could have been explored a bit more in the film.
Yeah, it was also a bit odd that he simply had such... I mean, it was important in the film because they needed to create a way that the androids could get to the corporation CEO, because otherwise it would have been quite difficult for them to do that.
Yes.
But
would the corporation CEO, this downtrodden character who said everyone shunned, right? Would the corporation CEO be playing long-distance chess with this character?
Very odd. Very odd. As if there were a lot of things which for me didn't stand up to criticism, especially in the movie. I felt, okay, what you point out there, this sort of internal monologue, is something that we've seen in more recent books as well. I've seen it in the Hunger Games story. This internal monologue element is in a lot of modern writing, where people, that the heroes and heroines are constantly questioning their own worth, their own, I suppose, importance within a rebellion. But in this case, we talk about individuals who are talking about their sense of self-worth, but there isn't really any social function that this criticism or self-criticism has. As in, they're not talking about sacrificing themselves for the greater good. They're not talking about how everybody else are reliant upon them, as is the case in Hunger Games, for example. But when we're talking about the book, everybody else are simply background clutter.
I think that's one of the things that this book is trying to say. I think that everyone in this book is out for themselves and them alone, apart from maybe their wife. But if you think about all the characters, there is almost no connection with anyone else in the book.
Yeah. So, but also in the movie.
Also in the movie. I think it's saying that after a nuclear war, humanity will basically become each for themselves. That's it.
We're almost there now.
Well, exactly. Yeah, we haven't even needed a nuclear war. I hope we don't get there. But I just feel as though that's a deliberate voice from the book warning us of where we might lead this.
I see that, but to be honest, I kind of felt a bit disconnected myself as a result. As in, I thought the book was entertaining, but it's not something that I would probably revisit. As in, there's a second part as well, but I probably won't read it. I don't know why. It didn't inspire in me the sense that I have to read the next bit. And the movie, I watched it, and I have to say, I was quite disappointed with the movie.
Have you seen it previously?
I'd not seen it before, and so therefore I picked it up, obviously, in 2025, and watching a movie which is 43 years old or what? No, when did it come out? 1982. Yeah. So therefore, it's over 40 years old. Even though this was a version which had been cleaned up a bit, I think about 10 or 12 years ago, but still, it's extremely dated. The acting is also very, very simplistic. I don't think Harrison Ford will look back on this movie and think, oh, wow, that's great. Daryl Hannah, I don't know if this was one of her main or first main roles and so on, but she also didn't particularly play the kind of character which you'd say, okay, that's inspirational, nor Rutger Hauer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as in, I really feel, because I've seen movies with all three of these actors since then, and they are wonderful actors, a lot of them, you know.
The script's the problem.
I'm not sure if it's the script. I'm not sure if it's the fact that you know, they decided we need to cut out as much from the book as possible because I can't be bothered to go there. The ending for me was so uninspiring.
Well, it's very different to the book, as well. The ending.
It is. It's, yeah, and I don't want to do any spoilers, but it's just completely uninspiring.
I think it's too late for that. I think that ship sailed, hasn't it?
Well, no, but I mean, I'm probably saving people, you know, two hours or whatever of of basically trying very hard not to look at their phone. But it's, yeah, I was disappointed, particularly by the ending, because I can never run, and it's not just this movie. Yeah, there are also other movies where the entire movie is based on one person probably trying to kill another person, but then when they get to the point of trying to kill the other person, they decide not to, and so the other person kills them. Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, so what exactly was the point of that pursuit? And I kind of got a similar feeling here. So therefore, okay, forget the spoiler alert. That's just been cancelled, officially abandoned. Anyway, okay, but what about you? I mean, okay, I look at it in this way, not particularly complimentary. How do you see it? It was your choice, therefore. Don't feel bad.
This is the reason why we have these things. If we all loved everything, there'd be no point. I enjoyed the book. As I said, when I first watched the film, I was doing it quite superficially as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old boy. Having rewatched the film, I think I did take more from it than I did before, the last time, but I think that's because I've read the book. I think the book has a lot more to say. The film just, it's a lot of pictures and music and movement, and it's all very pretty for that, but there's not much depth to it.
No. It's very superficial. I read the book before, I listened to the book before I watched the movie. So I wanted to do it in that order because usually the book is better than the movie. In this case, it wouldn't have taken much, to be honest, to have achieved that particular distinction. But book.
So did you enjoy the book when you were having read it, or did you just not connect with it?
I think that there are a number of elements within the book which could have been further pursued. I think it would have been better if the book had been a bit longer to have pursued those things, but I'm not sure that the author really wanted to pursue and communicate those messages. I can't necessarily say it's because, yeah, it was written in the 1960s and said that therefore they were far more simplistic. No, because there are classical novels written. I mean, David Copperfield is one, for example, where you are just sent on this emotional roller coaster, and there is a depth to the characters in David Copperfield that I just did not get from this book at all. And this may be an unfair comparison to make because
David Copperfield is probably one of the best pieces of writing from the 19th century that
David Copperfield is probably my favorite standalone book ever written. And so therefore, that kind of, for me, is the ultimate standard. So a lot of books are going to fall short from that. But I'm just saying that the depth of character, which I would love to read about, that is to be found in David Copperfield, was so lacking in this that it was quite easygoing, as it were. It didn't take too much effort for me to understand what was going on and also some of the intricacies. But yeah, it really fell short of what I would consider to be material for me to really enjoy.
I think the comparison between this David Copperfield is a difficult one to make, because David Copperfield is very much a book that's written of a time, very emotional. As you're reading it, you can't but help to really, feel one way about certain characters and another way about others. There's some very obviously good characters in David Copperfield, some very obviously bad characters, and there's a lot in between. You're led through this person's life, and I get what you're saying. I think what you're saying is that you don't really connect with any of the characters in this book, and therefore, for reason, you didn't really get to enjoy it because you didn't care enough.
Absolutely, and also, I mean, let's talk about a different author that we both know who is nowhere near in the league of Dickens, and let's mention Piers Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we both read Step and Alp, and it's a much smaller book, I would imagine, and I connect to that character. And this is also like a sci-fi novel from that kind of era. Maybe Step was written a bit later, but still, it's a shorter book. It doesn't go into so much depth, and yet you connect automatically with the main characters. I get that.
I understand what you're saying, but I think this book not trying necessarily as hard to do that. It is what it's trying to do is make you think about a few questions that are set within the book. Some of them as warnings as to what the future may hold if certain actions by humanity are taken, and others just generally. I mean, we haven't talked about it today, but in the film, Robert Powell's main line for me in the film is towards the end. It's actually just before the ending, but you can't discuss. Robert Powell says, quite annoying experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave. Now, we have these androids, so that element of it is they're not just androids who are set, they see themselves. Roy Batty sees himself in the film as a slave, and it's not just rebelling and coming to Earth and causing havoc. He's come to Earth because he wants to live on, he wants to be free, and he wants to meet his maker and have that discussion, which at least he does do. Not the best ending for
not for the maker.
No, there are questions in the book which are raised, and you're meant to think on them for yourself. So when I saw that, I did finally have some emotional attachment to Roy Batty's character, which up until that point you don't do.
True,
because you don't really understand what his motivations are. Why is he here? Why are they doing all this? But through the scene where he meets the Whisper to Tyrell. And subsequently, towards the end, when he and the main protagonist get together, and this The scene ensues as it does, and he ends up actually saving his life, knowing that his is about to expire. It's actually quite, I found that quite an interesting way to finish that section of the film off.
Yeah, I think that was the only part of the movie that actually resonated with me. And in some ways, though, that's also a source of disappointment. Because at no point through the movie did you feel that that's where this character was going. This character was always presented as some kind of evil overlord.
I think it's a plot twist they've put in the film. I think that's their, I'm hoping that that's their, because that's how the director wanted you to see it. Well, he wanted you to identify with what was an obvious good character, bad character situation, right up until the very last moment. And then he pulls out, well, that's not what's going on here.
Yeah. But then also in the question of Harrison Ford's character, Rick Deckard, I mean, it's at that point, it's bad character versus bad character, isn't it?
Yeah. Throughout the book, he's questioning his own motivations and his own behavior. As I said, I preferred the book by some distance to the film, but I thought both had interesting points to make. I just wish the film had a little bit more substance behind the cinematography and the music and all that. That's my one regret there.
Cool. Okay. As I always ask, would you recommend the book to somebody to read?
Only if they enjoy sci-fi. And or have an interest in AI. And I think they could find the concepts. As you said, there are better books out there as just general reads. There are better books out there. There are better sci-fi books out there.
Definitely.
If what you want is an emotional roller coaster, especially if you want something that's going to take you along with it and make you feel as though you're involved. This doesn't do that. You're disconnected from every character in the book and the film. You never feel as though you're really rooting for anyone. So from that point of view, it's probably not for everyone. But for people who are interested in AI and thought-provoking questions that may raise, and for those who like sci-fi, I do think it's an interesting read. It doesn't take that long, because it's not that long a book.
Fair enough. Cool. Yeah, I'll more or less go along with that. I think you're right. Definitely right to point out as well that there are other books in the genre which I would likely point people towards before that one. I'll leave my criticisms there. Okay. For the next one then, Greg, you've got a very interesting option for us.
Yeah, I mean, this was supposed to be your turn, but you've kind of let me take it. I'll do so. So it's called Crooked Cross by Sally Carson.
Very good. Okay, so I will make a note of that here so that I can get through that as well. I'm not sure how long it will take us to get through. Have you read it already, or is it something that you're going to read?
I've literally just started it.
Oh, okay, that's good.
It's an interesting concept, I think.
Okay. Cool. All right. Yeah, good. In that case, then I will get onto it as well at some point. I'll probably wait a couple of weeks because you're not as quick as I am when it comes to getting through these things. Are you reading it, though, or is it an audiobook?
This is an audiobook.
Oh, okay. Oh, so,
yeah.
Greg, thanks a lot, man. Even though it wasn't really a book for me, I'm actually really happy that you recommended it because, as you said before, previously, we've liked almost every book that we've read. And it comes to a certain point where people may listen and think, okay, you just like books, so what's the point? You're just going to like everything that you read. So I think it's also nice to show that, actually, no, we're not quite as simplistic as that in our assessments. And so therefore, there is a bit of variety. And I thank you for that.
Thank you. If I may, I'd just like to finish with what Roy Batty is told by Mr. Tyrell. Which is when the reason that he can't extend his life, he whose light burns twice as bright burns for half as long.
Yeah, and that can also be used to illustrate also the lives of other luminaries who have existed in the arts and crafts and
indeed. I don't suspect that that's that was quote was made by Tyrell or indeed Mr. Dick, but it was just putting it to Roy Batty as the reason as to why he's going to die within 4 years of coming into existence. That's his justification for it.
Thank you also for reminding me that there was an endearing line that was introduced at the end of the movie. I'd completely forgotten about that. So, Greg, thank you very much for your analysis and also for sacrificing your time to have a conversation with your brother. So, it's a hard life, I tell you. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All the best to you, bud. And yeah, speak to you next time.
It's a goodbye from me.
Two and a mic. Two and a mic.